Welcome to a Sober Girls Guide podcast, a lifestyle podcast based on sobriety and recovery. I'm your host and sober girl, Jessica Jabot. Inspired by my own sobriety and wellness journey, I want to spread the wealth of knowledge. Tune in each week for uncensored conversations about mental health, self-development, wellness and spirituality, and how they influence each guest's unique recovery journey. My goal is to educate and inspire and to let you know you are not alone on your recovery journey. Thanks so much for tuning in to a Sober Girls Guide podcast. Let's go! Hello, hello, and welcome to episode 258 of a Sober Girls Guide podcast. This is hands down my favorite episode of the year thus far. Haley McGee is here to teach us how to stop people pleasing and master the art of self-advocacy. On this episode, Haley walks us through some step-by-step exercises and examples on how to use boundaries and how to tap into our needs and wants so you can advocate for them. Personally, setting boundaries is always scary, actually terrifying, because it seems so black and white. It's either this or that, my way or the highway, with zero room for gray. But Haley breaks it down and provides some life-changing tools to navigate through these situations and relationships. On this episode, you will learn why we people please, how to stop it, and what happens if we don't stop people pleasing. Spoiler alert, it's not great. But this episode is. So let's get into it. Haley, what's going on, girl?
Hi, I'm so excited to be here.
Me too. And I think this is a like long overdue topic. People pleasing.
It's such a thing.
It is such a thing. And I totally want to get into it because you are definitely the expert. I mean, you're a people pleasing coach. You know what to do. You know how to people coach people out of this scenario. But I want to also talk about your relationship with alcohol, because I think it's really interesting. It's interesting, but I'm also not surprised that we don't know each other. I reached out to you on Instagram. I loved your content. I love what you talk about. I love how you talk about it. I think it's really relatable and easy to understand. But you're also a sober girl.
Right?
Tell me about that.
It's wild. I mean, and we chatted about this before, but when you reached out to me, the timing was just totally wild because I was just about to celebrate 5 years. And so the synchronicity of it just felt very special.
But that is so cool. And congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you. It's so refreshing. But yeah, it's been, I feel like the sober journey and the people-pleasing recovery journey have been like a DNA helix for me. They're totally wound around each other for sure.
Ooh, okay. I definitely want to get into that because I notice, you know, myself and the women in our community definitely have a little issue with boundaries, people-pleasing. Like that's something we want to learn more at and get better at and really, you know, stand up for ourselves and empower ourselves. I think it's really important. But you tell us what your BS self looked like? Your before sobriety self. Can you give us a little behind the scenes of what that looked like?
Oh, absolutely. So definitely. So I was raised in a family that had like alcohol issues, basically. And when I was growing up, both my parents were sober and alcohol was spoken about in the house like the devil, because it had caused all these disastrous consequences. So growing up, I was so like type A teacher's pet. And I was like, I will never touch that stuff. Like I would never. Mm. And then, you know, 2 weeks into college, I'm at a party and I have my first drink. And just like so many other people, I just remember the wash of calm and the calming of my anxious, overactive mind. And I was like, oh, hell yeah. I was like, this is what I've needed. So steadily throughout college, my drinking increased. And I think I definitely embodied the like work hard, play hard attitude. Like I was hustling in classes and then every spare moment was just like, when's the next party? How can I score booze? Who can I hook up with tonight? Like it was very, very much like just excess and indulgence. And it sucked, you know, because looking back now, I think of all those times I could have spent like going out to brunch with my friends or forming like these robust friendships or having adventures. And it's just like, no, I was like hungover in bed till 3 o'clock if I was lucky. And it was hard, you know? So I'd say for me, it was almost like my drinking peaked in college. I managed to pull it back in a little bit after that. I didn't quit quite fully yet. I was like, I'm just going to try to rein it in a little, which I kind of did. But at a certain point, I just realized, even though I wasn't blacking out all the time or hooking up with people I didn't remember the next day, which happened all the time, I was still making promises to myself I couldn't keep. Like, I was still saying like, okay, at this show, I'm going to go see a concert tonight and I'll have 2 drinks and I would have 3 or 4. And I was like, this is not something I can control. Like, I was like, this is not my control. Like, I feel this persistent sense of broken trust with myself. And at the time, I was really grateful that there were a lot of people in like sobriety land saying like, you don't have to be an alcoholic to quit drinking per se. Like, you can make this choice for any reason. And whether or not I was an alcoholic still, I don't even know, but I decided I needed to quit because it wasn't great. Yeah. And so I did. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I love that you said that you don't need to be an alcoholic to change your relationship with alcohol.
Yeah. That is, I think that's a huge barrier to entry for people, you know?
It really is, right? Because if like, what are the qualifications for being an alcoholic? They're kind of loose. Like, you know, it's like, oh, you hit this certain amount of drinks per week or per night. I think it's a little more than that.
Right? And I often feel like we put people in that category when something disastrous happens. So like, oh, I hit someone with my car, so I'm this, or I did this. And what's crazy is looking back on my story, I could have done those things hundreds of times. It's just pure chance that I didn't suffer one of those incredibly like rock bottom consequences. So like, it's really arbitrary.
Yeah. So I think, and this is probably an unpopular opinion, but it's totally up to you what you want to label yourself, if you're an alcoholic or not, or you just want to change your relationship with alcohol, or you don't like how it makes you feel, or you're sick of, like you said, you know, not keeping promises to yourself. That's a huge reason. That's a reason enough. That's all you need to know. So what did that look like when you decided to change your relationship with alcohol and be like, okay, this is it. This is enough. I'm like done playing this game with myself. What did it look like?
So there were a few false starts. I'll be totally real about that. There were like, honestly, like maybe like 3 or 4 failed attempts where I'd collect a couple of weeks or months. And then my brain would do this really fascinating thing where all the rationalizations would come in and I'd say, it's look, you're fine. Like you can just, you know, drink normally. Or I went to a lot of therapy to heal some old like family wound stuff. And I was like, oh, well now I'm like fully healed. So now I can drink. Neither of those things were true.
The rationalization and justification, right? To just keep alcohol around.
Yes. So strong. I mean,
yeah,
our brains are amazing. The stories they can weave, and they felt so true at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, like this is a brilliant case. Like, and then after a couple rounds of that, I just got tired of my own bullshit, for lack of a better way of putting it. Like I'd seen the cycle happen enough where I was like, get off the tightrope, like stop living in this limbo. Like, please just commit to yourself because this feels like shit. And that was about 5 years ago. And so to sort of stick this commitment, I did try some 12-step stuff. It really helped me in the beginning. I tried some other sobriety programs like Recovery Dharma and Smart Recovery. I was non-dogmatic. I was like, I will try whatever it takes to help me. And different communities helped me in different ways. And I don't think I could have done it without the support of community, period. Mm. I needed that connection huge with people. Mm-hmm. It was huge. Yeah.
What did you learn from being in community with people who were like-minded?
I think the biggest thing was reduction of shame, because I'd swirled around the drain so many times. I had a lot of shameful stories about my lack of willpower or my lack of discipline or my ability to change. And so being in community with people who shared my experience and got it and kind of like illuminated a different way. It was just like, it was so good because in my experience, people who have never tried to quit drinking, they wish to understand and are really empathetic, but they can't fully understand just how hard it is.
Mm-hmm.
I needed that, you know, and the accountability, to be totally honest, that which was why I think 12-step really helped me in the beginning, like knowing every day I was going to show up to these people and sort of talk about staying sober another day. I mean, hey, I'm a life coach, right? I'm all about those specific accountable steps. And so I thrived in that environment.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, whatever works for you, right? Like you got to almost like learn how you learn, right? Like learn, like tap into your learning style. Because it's really important. Like let's, you know, help yourself out. Create some success for yourself.
And experiment, like, and I think like, and that requires experimenting and being honest with yourself about like, I'm trying this. Here's what works. Here's what doesn't. Here's what I need instead. And I'll be the first to admit I had to try so many different approaches and read so many different books by different authors with different opinions until I found what felt true for me.
Nice. I love that. I mean, it just sounded like you didn't give up. Like you were just willing to try something else, something different. Just keep on, pick yourself up, dust yourself off.
Absolutely. And every time there was one of those dark nights of the soul, because like they came in, of course, like I remember like there, a family drama and I'd pick up the phone and I would just feel so wrecked after and the temptation to drink would be so strong.
Mm.
And then just like normalizing that, like, ah, this is one of those dark nights of the soul. Like this is supposed to happen. It's normal that it's happening. And here's how I'm going to cope. You know what I mean? Because I think the temptation is to pathologize or be like, it shouldn't feel this hard. And it's like, oh no, like, yes, it should. You're right where you're supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, especially with family issues, it's so tough, especially with family, because it feels like, well, we're family. Should we have this like secret bond or secret code that should just make everything easier?
Yes.
No, that assumption right there makes everything 70 million times harder.
I could not agree more. That is a slippery slope.
Yeah. And I think also just there are assumptions in general that maybe things aren't supposed to be like this, or like you said, things aren't supposed to be that hard. I think that assumption can also just get in the way of just experiencing and just being like, hey, this is tough. This is reality. It's not going to be like this forever, but it is right now. And that's okay. That's it.
Yes. I think like that normalization of growing pains is so critical to my sobriety and also to the people pleasing stuff. Because when you're breaking any habit that served you for a long time and now no longer serves you, right? Like people pleasing or like drinking, it's like we need to retrain the part of us that has relied upon this thing for a sense of ease or safety or whatever. So yeah, the growing pains are very much a part of that.
Whoa. I think you just answered like one of my questions that I've been asking myself.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we people please?
Ooh, yes.
Right?
Let's talk about it.
Let's get into the people pleasing section, because I feel like they're very intertwined, especially your relationship with alcohol, because most people use alcohol to cope, to numb, to turn certain feelings and emotions off. And I feel like there's a lot of deep-seated emotions around why we people please.
Yes. This stuff goes deep.
Yeah. Could you shine a little light on why we people please?
100%. So I'll start by just giving like my working definition of what people pleasing is. Because I know it's like it's a catchphrase and it's like, what does that really mean? So people pleasing is the act of putting what we think others want, need, feel, or dream of at the expense and to the detriment of what we want, need, feel, and dream of. And I think what's important about that definition is the part of like what we think others want, because oftentimes we're not actually doing what they would want from us, which is often like honesty and clarity and things. So that's the definition I use. And really, you know, ultimately we can get the people pleasing pattern from many sources, but the thread that connects them all is safety. So we learn to people please as a method of staying not necessarily just physically safe, although in the more extreme cases, it can be that. It can also be emotionally safe, like I belong or I matter to someone, or socially safe, like I will fit in and I will be accepted, or even like materially safe. So if I do this, my basic needs will be tended to and met. And different origins. Yeah, it's so intense, right?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And the origins can be like family trauma or even like systemic oppression. Like if you occupy a marginalized identity, people pleasing, especially to authority figures, might be how you stay safe. Or if you were bullied, or if you were the caretaker of a parent. Basically, any situation where you could imagine, hey, people pleasing helps me get through this, that can be a situation that taught us this pattern.
Whoa. That makes so much sense. Like my mind is literally blowing because I'm like picturing myself and then picturing people that I interact. Like, why would they just say that? Why would they go along with something they don't even want to do?
Right.
Or like actually have a visceral, violent reaction to something, but they're doing it anyways.
The schism is wild. The fact that inside you can have this one feeling, but then externally you're presenting like everything. You could be enthusiastic. Yeah, I'd love to do that, even though you don't. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it comes down to safety.
It does. And what's wild is that in the present, we may not consciously be feeling unsafe. Like, you know, if I'm hanging out with my partner and he says, like, I want to go to get Thai food, and I get really nervous because what I want is sushi, but I'm too nervous to tell him that. It's not that I feel unsafe in the present. It's that in the past, moments of conflict or schism were actually unsafe to me in some way. So it's like I've just learned this software of how to run in those situations. But now in the present moment, as an adult with agency and choice and autonomy, the software isn't serving me anymore. So I need to learn how to update it. And that's kind of what breaking the people-pleasing pattern is all about.
Whoa, I love that. Okay, so I can see how what you mean by like just kind of keeping everything at an even keel and just going along, not rocking the boat. Because I mean, especially if you were raised with parents who were maybe a little unstable or like to lash out or, again, anything that felt unsafe, even those little tiny blips of like rocky communication or, I don't know, I wouldn't even call it a disagreement, but just like a little bit of conflict. But conflict can be good. Like, I think that's where we get just so confused.
Yeah, I think there's a major light bulb that turns on when at this stage we're able to see like, oh, like how might being honest and forthright and experiencing conflict be beneficial? Because what we don't think of when we're people pleasing is the long-term harms. We tend to think, oh, I'll just smooth this over right now. Or, oh, I don't want to fight with them about it. I'll just deal. And in a single moment, people-pleasing might seem like a good solution, right? Like, oh, look, now we're not fighting. Or, oh, look, now I can just manage this myself. But in the long term, if you do that over and over again, what happens is, first of all, you develop these extremely deep-seated resentments and frustrations because your needs aren't being met and you feel like you're constantly overgiving and under-receiving. Mm-hmm. Also, you have unintentionally presented a very dishonest version of you to the people in your life, and not maliciously, right? We don't do this on purpose.
Right.
But we end up feeling unknown and unseen by the people closest to us because we haven't presented our true selves. And then we often blame others for this, which is a really interesting thing that can happen.
Yes. I think, you know, what goes hand in hand is the people pleaser and the narcissist. Right? That's like salt and pepper.
Very much almost, so.
Right? Because they feed almost off of each other.
Yeah. And if the people pleaser lacks boundaries or the ability to assert themselves, I mean, those are almost like the garlic to the vampirical narcissist. And without it, it's unfortunate because we can end up in these dynamics that are just incredibly unbalanced and unhealthy.
Right. So what do we do? How do we stop this or correct it? Or I don't even know what would be the term.
Yeah. I think of it just like to break the pattern. I think of it as a two-part thing.
Okay.
And the first part is really relevant to sobriety stuff, actually, because as people pleasers, we've spent a lifetime living outside of ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. We're living in other people's heads, other people's emotions, so we have to come home to ourselves as the first step, which is similar to quitting drinking. Like I very much felt like becoming sober was a process of homecoming, learning to be with myself, my feelings, my emotions, my needs. And the way I see it, and I talk about this a ton in my book, setting boundaries gets a lot of airtime in the people-pleasing recovery world, as it should. Mm-hmm. But it's really hard to set a boundary advocating for our needs if we don't know what our needs are. And it's really hard to speak our truth if we don't know what we feel. So,
totally.
Right?
I think we're getting ahead with the whole boundary situation. That's like step, what, 3 or 4?
Exactly.
Okay.
We need that prerequisite of first really coming home to ourselves and familiarizing ourselves with our internal landscape. Like, and I'm talking basics. I'm talking feelings, needs, values, desires. All of these things are like a different foundation of who we are.
Okay.
And then with those, we can move into bringing more of that self to our relationships through the process of speaking honestly, setting boundaries around our limits, and the like.
Oof. I love that. And I love that you brought that up. It's because it's so true. I think everyone's on step 3 or 4 with like setting these boundaries and like, you know, boundaries are healthy. This, like, just do them. Just set a boundary. First of all, most people don't even know what boundaries are and exactly. why they're doing them or why they're coming to this or why you need to stop people pleasing.
Right.
So when we continue to be in this, what would you call people pleasing? A pattern, a cycle?
I think of it as just like a pattern.
Okay. So when we don't break this pattern, what do we have to look forward to?
It's not pretty, y'all. It's not great.
Or lack thereof.
Right? So yes. I think just at a foundational level, and tons of research really speaks to this, is that when we repeatedly suppress our needs and emotions, there can be like physical health consequences, everything from like autoimmune diseases to indigestion. There's tons of research that cites this. There's obviously mental health repercussions because we are not feeling actualized and we're not feeling connected to our agency, which can lead to depression, anxiety, and other, you know, other things. And then there are sort of like the still very important other aspects, right? Like our relationships feel inauthentic. We're chronically burnt out because we're giving more than we're comfortably able and ruining ourselves in the process. Mm-hmm. And we don't have healthy intimacy because intimacy literally requires that we let ourselves be seen by another. And people pleasing is like wearing a mask. I mean, we're just not showing it. So we feel really alone and disconnected. It sucks.
Yes. It sucks, but also listening to this, I'm like, yep, I can see why I do that. I can see what mask to throw up here and there. Because it is, like, I don't know about you, but I think my worst fear would probably be judgment. So in order to keep myself safe from judgment, I'll throw up a couple little masks. I mean, they're not full, like, opaque masks. They're kind of like a little bit see-through, like you kind of like, just like a blurred kind of mask.
Totally. And this is the part, I think, having self-compassion then, right? Like, I see, like, this is the, I think of it as like a tired old warrior. Like, this is that warrior who kept me safe for such a long time. And I can see why they did that. It really worked in the past. And then it's being able to separate the past from the present and say, oh, but now, even under this slightly see-through mask, these people aren't getting to see who I really am. And I'm feeling really lonely and disconnected because of that. And that hurts. Like, maybe there's a different way, yeah. You know, it's like retiring that good old warrior who did a good job for a really long time.
Yeah. Giving her a little pat on the back.
Right. Good job, buddy. Yes. I'll take it from here.
Definitely. So what would you suggest to people to like take the first steps? Like, what would be the first kind of like actionable steps to maybe looking at the cycle and wanting to make adjustments to this pattern or cycle that they're in?
Yeah. So I'd say a really simple first step, would be to do the process of identifying your feelings and then identifying the unmet needs beneath them. Like, this is a really simple two-part process of homecoming. It's usually the first place I go with clients.
Yeah.
So the first step, and for some people, this is old hat. For some people, this is brand new. Paying attention to your feelings and being able to notice and name when you have uncomfortable or unpleasant feelings. Things like resentment, anger, overwhelm, burnout. Because those feelings, for many of us, they've become so commonplace that we might not even like identify them in the moment. Mm-hmm. But they're like signposts that point to our unmet needs beneath them. They're like messengers.
Ooh, okay.
You know,
can you give
and
me
I
an
can't.
Example?
So, for example, I feel resentful in my friendship with Sally. Okay. So once I identify, oh, whoa, I'm feeling really resentful, then I can ask myself, what unmet need is this resentment communicating to me? So underneath resentment, often we have needs for fairness, for support, for respect or kindness, right? And so when I identify that, and that can take practice, it can take, you might even like look at a big old list of needs and read it through and say, all right, which ones do I need?
I'm more at like step one, what is this feeling?
Right though? But truly.
How to articulate feeling beyond like, oh, this is uncomfortable.
Right?
Well, why is it uncomfortable? Yeah.
Oh my God. And for those of us who have like drinking, it's like in the past, there wouldn't be a feeling acknowledgement. There would be like, where is my fireball?
Yeah. Like it's that's like knee jerk reaction. Like, oh, things are getting a little hairy, a little too feeling around here. Gotta reach for that glass of wine. Gotta reach for something else.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Which is why like quitting, at least for me, and I'm sure for so many, like when I did quit drinking, it was like this enormous tsunami of feelings was like racing toward me. And I was like, oh my fucking God. Like, you know?
Right? Yep. Like, have you not, like, I don't think I've ever cried so much in my first year of sobriety than in my entire life.
Oh my, absolutely. Unequivocally, yes.
Yes.
Unequivocally, yes.
Yeah. Like, just so a like, tap won't turn off.
Oh my God, the feel, I mean, and it's so intense. Like, I think we have to have some compassion for ourselves here. Like, clearly this is what, for, I'll speak for myself. Clearly this is what the drinking was protecting me from feeling. So now I got to feel it. And this, again, I just feel like these two journeys, this is why I said the sobriety and the people-pleasing recovery is like a DNA helix because they're so wound into each other. Because when I was drinking all the time, I wasn't noticing the difficult feeling. And I certainly wasn't trying to identify the unmet need beneath it. And as a result, like my life passed by, I was constantly feeling chronically like I wasn't getting what I needed or wanted, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to shift it.
That's so fascinating that you say that because I felt the exact same way too. And I think how I dealt with it as well, like I would just be very angry. Mm. And then people would tell me that I'm angry. And then I'd be like, well, I guess I'm just an angry person.
Oh, wow.
And then I'd keep drinking because when I got angry, I really hated being an angry person because I really didn't feel like I was like angry. Like that's not like just a personality trait that I naturally take on.
Yeah.
And so I would drink to not be angry. How insane is
How
that?
Wild. Right.
Right?
It's- it's like not a solution, but in the moment it almost feels like one.
It does. Like, it really does. Because yeah. like you don't know where to kind of like, where does this start and where do we start like kind of unraveling these things that we need to like almost unlearn that aren't true.
Mm-hmm. And like how to sit with, again, like the emotional intensity once we start unlearning.
Yeah.
Like I really feel like in both of these processes, the hardest part and one of the most important ones is being able to literally just like sit with a difficult emotion mm-hmm. instead of trying to numb it or run away from it. God, the parallels are wild to me. Like I talk about this a lot when it comes to self-advocacy. So like boundaries, which we will talk about because they are important. Like, yeah. okay, I need to do this thing, like stop drinking or set a boundary with someone. Yeah. And I'm so freaking terrified because of all the emotions I anticipate I will feel, like guilt, shame, judgment, self-consciousness. And it's going to frankly be really, really hard to advocate for yourself if you don't have a way or a plan for how to soothe through those difficult emotions. Because the moment they hit, the temptation to like take back the boundary or like reach for the bottle is going to be really, really strong.
Yeah. Because also this is like new and uncomfortable. And yeah, like just like delete, delete, delete. That didn't happen.
Like, wait, can we just delete it? Back?
Yeah. But I mean, let's talk about boundaries and why they're important. Like, okay, say, you know, we've come to kind of terms, we can articulate our emotions, we can articulate our needs and our wants. We've done the work of coming home to ourselves. Next step is boundaries and putting those bad boys out there.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we need to do that? Why can't we just be like, oh, I know what I'm feeling, I know what I need, I want, and that's it?
Yeah. So great question. I mean, I think ideally, wouldn't that be great if that were enough? Like, wow. But I think like if we want to have relationships, which I would argue the vast, vast majority of us do, and we need them. The bottom line is like, we are not miniature, like replicas of each other. In every relationship, no matter how healthy, there will be areas where there are mismatches and disagreements and conflicts, simply by nature of the fact that we are not clones of one another. And so knowing how to navigate those things is helpful. And what I like to say sort of in the flow, if we're like, all right, the flow, feeling, got it, the unmet need, got it, okay, then what? I often like to insert the idea that before we set a boundary, it's often really helpful to make a request, which I see as like the often like under-noticed character in this story.
Okay.
Because a boundary... I'll explain the distinction. So like a boundary in essence is a separation between one thing and another. That's like the simplest way of thinking of a boundary. So like if I set a boundary with someone, that might look like inserting more space in our connection. It might look like saying no to something they've asked me to do. It might look like, and at the most extreme cases, it can look like leaving the relationship altogether. All of those are examples of boundaries. However, before we get to that point, especially in what we might consider a healthy relationship, it's worth trying to collaborate to resolve the unmet need by simply asking someone if they can meet us where we need to be met. Like, hey, I've been feeling really disconnected lately. I need more connection. Would you be open to hanging out more often? Like, I know that's really vulnerable to say.
Yeah.
And yet many of us operate on this weird paradigm that other people should just know what we need without ever being asked or told.
Weird. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Me neither. This is all purely hypothetical, of course.
Yeah. This is someone else.
Yeah, I definitely have never experienced this at all. But if I did... I might have believed that, oh yeah, like they should just know that they're asking too much of me. They should just know that when they're sarcastic, it hurts my feelings. They should just know, right? And if we pause for a second, like that's a pretty selfish attitude actually, because what it assumes is that everyone else loves, thinks, cares, and exists the exact same way that we do. which is ridiculous, right?
Yes. I think now that you're saying it that way, yes.
Yeah. Again, hypothetically, not that we've been there at all. And even things like cultural differences, trauma histories, sensitivities, like, so all of these things fit into our unique profile of like how we show up in the world. And if we rush right into boundary territory, being like, okay, they can't meet my needs, so I need distance from them. Like, we're allowed to do that, but look at all the missed opportunity that could arise if we're vulnerable enough to make a request around what we need. And even if they can't meet our needs precisely the way we ask them to, then perhaps there's an opening of a conversation. Like, what are some alternative solutions? How can we compromise? All of these things get left out when we rush right into boundary territory.
I absolutely love that. And I don't think I've ever heard anyone describe it like that or even suggest kind of like collaboration or what did you call it? How did you label it? Request.
Making requests. Yeah.
Yeah. Because honestly, that sounds so much more doable than just coming out of the gate and be like, guns a-blazing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it sounds so, a boundary to me personally sounds so like forever. Like, boundaries, it sounds like so intense, and I have to have like a very straight face. I have to not try and cry while I get through this boundary.
Right?
But, yeah. But how you describe that, yeah, like coming together and having a request and just be like, hey, like, are you open to this? Are you open to like talking? Are you open to trying something different? How awesome and like non-threatening is that?
Oh my God. And it's so cool because it gives other people the chance to know what we need and to meet us there. Like, and I truly believe that in healthy relationships, I was thinking about this. I'm like, do I believe this? Yeah, I do. I do believe that we kind of owe people that opportunity. If, now, of course, I'm big on like nuance because I don't think anything's black and white. So like, yes, if we are in a like abusive or toxic relationship and someone has consistently been horrible to us, of course, like it's not super reasonable to be like, hey, would you mind, like, would you be open to not, you know, harming me like this? Like, in those cases, maybe going right to a boundary is a good idea. But in healthy relationships, like, I don't know. I think it's important.
Yeah. I always ask myself, like, do I love, trust, and respect this person? Most of the time it's yes, because I wouldn't be feeling so, well, I wouldn't be feeling anything. Let's be honest.
Right.
But I love, trust, or respect them. Ugh, chances are, you know, you got some feelings there. Imagine that.
Right.
So yeah, like, I think that relationship is owed, you know, a chance to collaborate, a chance to make a request.
Yeah.
Because chances are that person loves, trusts, and respects you.
And right? We sometimes don't know. That's right. And like, sometimes we don't know. Like, here's a great, I love this story, if I can share one real quick.
Yeah.
So I recently put out a reel about this that went viral because it seemed to really strike something in people. It was about communication differences and how we can communicate differently. So for me, I'm what you might call like an invite only. So I often only feel comfortable really sharing in detail about myself if someone asks me a question.
Okay.
Whereas on the other side of that equation, there are what I call volunteers. And these are people who feel really comfortable just kind of sharing about themselves freely and injecting themselves into the conversation. Cool. Okay. Yep. So we're flip side.
Yeah.
So these two types can, on the one hand, they can both be great for different reasons, but they can also both resent each other.
Totally.
Volunteers, people like in your shoes, for example, may feel that invite onlys are really guarded or lacking in vulnerability. And they may feel like, why am I the one always leading this conversation? Like, why won't they just speak up? Right. Whereas invite onlys might feel like, God, why are these volunteers? Like, why are they so self-centered? How come they're never curious about me? You're laughing.
Yep.
So this is a dynamic. So a couple of years ago, I'll never forget. So this is how I've operated in my relationships. And a couple of years ago, I had two friendships, separate friendships, where I was like, oh my God, like these women, I feel like when we hang out, they just talk and talk and they never ask me about myself. And I feel so unseen. And my first instinct was, I'm going to cut them out. Boundary.
Ooh.
But I was working on all this stuff that I'm now teaching in my book. So I was like, hold on. What if you just vulnerably made a request and expressed what you feel and need? I was like, whoa, that's new. Right?
So how did you make this request?
So get this. This is the crazy part. So I sat each of them down separately and had a conversation that basically went like, hey, recently I've been noticing that I'm feeling like our conversations are a little imbalanced. And I feel like I'm feeling like I'm not getting a lot of curiosity from you about my experience. So would you be open to like asking more questions or just like, you know, getting a little more curious about me and my life? This is like a super condensed version.
Okay.
So get this. This is a great example of how other people will not know what we need and feel until we tell them. Okay. Both of these women looked shocked and sad. And they said, oh my God, Haley, this whole time I've been feeling like you haven't really wanted to be close to me because you never share what's going on for you. So this whole time, like I felt like you were keeping me at arm's length and it was making me feel really sad and disconnected. And I was like, oh my God, I thought you were like this selfish, self-centered person. And you thought I was this guarded, invulnerable jerk. So, and both of us were like, wow, I'm so glad we talked about this. Let's strategize. Right. Yeah. And so we did. And it was the most like learning experience moment probably of my life so far. One of them.
Haley, you know what really stood out to me when you just said this?
Mm.
No one was wrong or right.
Bingo.
In that situation. Because I was kind of ready to be like, oh yeah, like those bitches, they didn't ask you anything. Like that's rude.
Yes.
And like take a side, right?
Yep.
But listening to how you describe that, no one was right and no one was wrong.
Just different experiences, just different perspectives. Yep.
Yes. So yes. No one's doing any of this intentionally.
That is exactly right. Right? And like, whoa. What a learning moment. And then, so if you extrapolate that to other situations, like in listeners, like your own lives, where like you're maybe writing a story in your head about why they're not meeting your needs.
Mm-hmm.
Pause naturally. And like naturally, right? Because we all do this. It's so normal. But stop to consider like, if you present your needs and feelings to them, perhaps you will experience the other side of the story. And we can't know for sure how they'll respond unless we share. And I was lucky. You know, I was lucky. I was in a situation where they heard me and they were committed to meeting my needs. That may not always be true, right? But at least then we know before we just cut things off without knowing that.
Yeah. Like giving them a kind of chance to, I mean, I also could have seen this going in a very defensive situation.
For sure.
That's also a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Especially but, when we make a request that shows like how someone's behavior may have hurt us.
Yes.
If that triggers shame in someone, the likelihood of defensiveness,
definitely flare up. Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, that has nothing to do with you. Like you literally just said, if they have shame around how they maybe treated you or acted in a situation, that has everything to do with them, like what's going on inside of them. Right?
Exactly. I think so. And like something I like to say, like when I'm teaching this stuff is just like, also when we bring obviously how we bring stuff up matters. And like an easy lead in to a conversation just like this one might be like, hey, I know this might be kind of hard to hear, but I want to be honest with you because I care about our relationship. And then like insert thing here. Right? Like just a simple lead up like that, that shows them because this is why we don't want to people please anymore. Like, I don't want to people please because I care about you. I want to be honest with you. And I want our relationship to last. that's why we do this stuff in the first place, usually.
Yes. 100%. I mean, but that also sounds very terrifying.
Right?
That's how you said it. I'm like, oof, that sounds good in theory, but I'm like, ooh, the lips are starting to quiver.
Ooh. It is so scary.
Yeah.
It really is. Especially if you feel like someone won't be receptive. Like, and that, so then to me, the question is when you say that sounds terrifying, it's like, yes. And at this moment, we have a fork in the road. We can either listen to the fear and then obey the fear and not do the scary thing, which is a totally viable option.
Okay.
Or we can say, no matter what, breaking the people-pleasing pattern will be scary. So how do I soothe myself through this very natural fear? Which gets into what we talked about before, about how like knowing how to soothe ourselves through those emotions is like just as much a part of the experience, I think.
Totally. And doing anything new is going to feel very uncomfortable and scary anyways. Like that's included. Fear included.
100% guarantee. Right? Right?
Totally. Totally.
Oh my God.
I love how just how you say that and how you just go about things. I think rushing to a boundary seems so just intense for me. And I'm sure it does for a lot of people. I mean, they have their time and place, but I love how just the open communication and open to collaborating and compromise.
Yeah.
I like that step.
It's so better. Yeah, man. I think it's so human. Like, I really think that step is what, it's like a healthy relationship step. You know, like to me, this is just like, that's how I'd want to be interacted with. You know, that's what I would wish for.
Totally. So say we have to go to the boundary step.
Yes. Let's say.
How do we do it?
So often, so let's imagine, let's keep with this thing. Let's imagine we make a request and the other person is either A, just so unreceptive, like screw that, no.
Okay. Or defensiveness.
Defensiveness, like, right, exactly. And or let's imagine that they say, oh yeah, I'll meet that need. And then their actions don't reflect their words. And then this happens over and over again. So same outcome. It's essentially like they're saying no, but they're saying yes with their words, but not with their actions. And we have to trust people's actions, right? Yeah. That's what we live with.
Totally.
That is when I suggest moving into boundary territory.
Okay.
And the simplest question that can help us figure out what our boundary should be is, how close and connected am I willing to be to this person, given that they cannot meet my need for X? Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. What does that bring up?
Because I feel like when we have to go to this extreme, for some reason, it's always with like a very close person. Like, I don't know, your mother. There, I'm going to say it.
Heck yeah. Family dynamics.
Yeah.
Yep. That's what makes boundaries so hard, because I think
totally
the people who like get under our skin the most are often the people we're closest with, because like they're in, you know?
Yeah.
And what I want to say for those who are listening, who are like, oh, like you're telling me I have to cut off my mom. It's like, so here's a metaphor that I'd like you to think about. I don't know if anyone's ever been to a concert, but if you go to a concert, there's often someone in the back working the soundboard. And it's this giant box with all these different knobs and twisters to adjust the sound, right? We can think of the soundboard when we're answering this question of how close and connected am I willing to be to this person? And every little knob can be an aspect of the relationship. So one knob on the soundboard might be, for example, how often do I spend time with them? Another knob might be when we spend time together, for how long? Are we talking like a 30-minute chat or a 6-day hangout? Another knob might be, how vulnerable do I get with them? Do I share with them everything about like politics, sex life, religion, or do I keep it pleasantries? all of these knobs are things that can be twisted and adjusted to create a more comfortable relationship for us. Does that make sense? Like, that's what our boundary can look like, is twisting those knobs.
Totally.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I kind of just viewed it as one knob.
Mm. What was the knob? Just like whether you're in my life
on or off.
Yep. I call that the light switch metaphor.
Yeah, that's actually a better knob. The description of the knob. Yeah, it's either like all in or all out. Yeah, there's no temperature. There's no dimmer switch that it is a full up or down, yes or no, black or white.
I think this is why boundaries feel so scary to so many people, is because there's this assumption that it's only the light switch.
Yeah.
And in my teaching, something I really try to help folks see is that, like, oh my God, there's so many shades of gray. Like, I'll share this. I'm sure people can relate. I have a family member who I love for many reasons, and who also gets on my nerves because we are complete and polar political opposites. I'm sure so many families have this dynamic.
Yep.
For the longest time, I used requests. I would ask this person to respect my beliefs. I would ask them to change their mind. Didn't happen, because sometimes people don't change and they're allowed to not change. But then the ball's in my court. And for the longest time, I was like, dang, does this mean I have to like cut this person out of my life? Mm. Is that my only option? And for some people, that would have been their choice, and it would have been a completely valid choice. Mm-hmm. For me, instead, what I decided to do was adjust the knobs. So what I adjusted with this person was the topics we discussed. I took politics I twisted that knob down a little bit. I realized I'm not willing to talk about this with this person anymore because it never goes anywhere and it makes me pissed and tired. So twisting that knob down. And then I also twisted the knob of, like, honestly, like how often we communicate. It wasn't a huge adjustment. I still communicate with this person frequently, but I also decided it couldn't be quite as regularly anymore because of how taxing those interactions were. And lo and behold, I twisted those knobs. Does that mean the relationship is perfect? No, but it means it's at a bearable amount of discomfort that still allows me to enjoy this person's presence in my life.
Mm. Oh my God. I love this. I love how you just described this. This is blowing my mind.
I'm so stoked it lands.
It's not just a light switch. Like, there's all these knobs. There's all these adjustments that can be made. It's not
so many.
Definite.
Yep.
I love Truly. That.
There's so much freedom and room for, again, experimentation in this process.
Yes, definitely. Haley, where can we find you and where can we get your book? Because we all need a copy of this, obviously.
Oh my God. So, like, literally everything we talked about today is in this book. And it's called Stop People Pleasing and Find Your Power. And it's available, I mean, all the places, right? Like Amazon, Barnes and Noble. And I'm so excited about this book because there's so many practical steps related to what we talked about today that are intended to help you move through this pattern and just break it. Just break it.
I love it.
So snag that if you can. And then also you can find me, my website's HaleyMcGee.com, and Instagram's where I'm posting all that stuff every day. And I'm at Haley Page McGee there.
Perfect. And your content is so good. And you give tips and tricks on your page.
Like, yeah.
Really great, really great stuff that you can do immediately, right then and there.
And
get yourself a copy of that book for sure. Haley, this has been such, I got a lot of stuff to talk about with my therapist. Let's just, we got a whole new chapter to run through with my therapist. And I'm very grateful, very grateful for that. Thank you so, so much for sharing your experience, your knowledge, and giving us some practical tips to really getting out of this people-pleasing pattern. This is so enlightening. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so fun.
I don't know about you, but I cannot get enough of this conversation, and I want more of Haley. So make sure to pre-order her book now, because it is jam-packed with tips and tricks to overcoming people-pleasing and standing in your power. One last thing before you go, it is important to remember that everyone's experience changing their relationship with alcohol is different. However, one thing that remains consistent is the need for support. Head to asobergirlsguide.com now because we have tips and tricks at any stage of your booze-free journey. We got your back. From live coaching calls, homework, and exercises to implement into your life ASAP, our Sober Girls Guide group coaching will give you the accountability, structure, community, and support to change your relationship with alcohol and never look back. This could be the day you stop doing that self-destructive thing you do. Let's get it. Head to asobergirlsguide.com now. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.